What if every student had a tutor and personalized learning was available to everyone? What if every family had a financial guide and their investments made for an optimistic future? What if every doctor could diagnose you in seconds and healthcare visits felt more personal? What if your business never slept and every customer's shopping experience felt like it was designed especially for them? It can with Agentforce, the powerful AI from Salesforce.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Nicholas Eberstadt of the American Enterprise Institute. His book, Men Without Work, republished as a post-pandemic edition, and we will come to what Nick can tell us of the statistics after the shutdown of the American economy in the late winter, early spring of 2020. But now to two of Nick's colleagues, Henry Olson and Jared Bernstein, who contribute a different look at the men without work statistics we've been discussing. I begin with Henry Olson because he speaks of recessions. There have been seven since the war, I believe, Nick, is that what you provide. And he points to the twin shocks of the 1970s. Why so? What does that mean for him?
Well, so Henry is talking about the recession and stagflation, the big shocks that came to the economy, where we started to see the decline in manufacture, or the really acceleration of the decline in manufacturing. And Henry and other critics, and I think it's great to include some critics and dissent in a book because you got the argument started, have pointed to these structural changes as being fundamentally unfavorable to the former male sort of employment mode.
The observation is that you've overestimated government causes and underestimated the change in labor market. That would be the twin shocks of the 1970s. And yet there's more here. This is what was known as the Rust Belt, right, Nick? The deindustrialization, yes, exactly, of the Midwest. In reading your book, I had this image in my mind, I don't know, about factories getting out and seeing this team of human beings moving in this way, all men, and then they go through the front gate and go on to their lives that day. And then the next day, they'd reverse the course. That was possible in the 1960s, but it was all gone by the 1970s. I'm imagining how Henry Olson is looking, yeah, at this. How does that change men without work?
Well, Henry would argue, I think, that big economic and structural changes in our system economy had a lot to do with the demand for labor in the United States. And that this was a major driver of the patterns that I am now describing. I think that would be fairly representing some of Henry's arguments.
Yes. And so these shocks continue. Each time there's a plunge and then a recovery of a men in participating in the labor force. But it is not consistent with entitlements, he says. Economic changes push men out. What entitlements is he talking about? Is this unemployment checks or more considerable?
More considerable than just unemployment, because remember, people who have dropped out of the labor force are not eligible for unemployment. They're not unemployed. You have to be looking for a job to get an unemployment benefit. One of the key social insurance benefits is disability program payments for people who qualify as unable to work. And in the period right before the pandemic and the years before the pandemic, as I show in this book, over half of the guys who are neither working nor looking for work are obtaining at least one of these benefits. About two-thirds of them live in a home that's getting one or more of these disability benefits.
That's what we call the safety net. And Henry Olson points to the SSDI, which is Social Security Disability Insurance.
Yeah.
Rising, actually he uses the word soaring, during the Great Recession of 2008 to 2010. And that is evidence for him that these are men who are gaming the system. Is that how he sees it?
I think he sees this as a kind of a lifeline for them, that this is something where that their jobs have gone away, and the SSDI or some of the other systems too are sort of an alternative income source to what previously had been work.
That would be true if there weren't jobs available. I understand that. And we'll come to that. But right now I want to turn to Jared Bernstein. We've established that Henry Olson thinks that it's shocks to the system caused by changes in the economy, the labor force itself, either deindustrialization or digitalization or the move into the 21st century of the globalization. But Jared Bernstein, first of all, identifies that we all know this, Nick. Well, I didn't know it. So I'm pleased to know that you political economists knew about a ghost army. I didn't. I always thought it was the unemployed, but you're quite discerning. He also identifies this as a left-right issue. I didn't know that either, Nick. Unemployment, I was unaware, was partisanship. But okay, fine. He identifies it as such. Now we come to some terms of art that you need to help us with. If I understand your general argument about where this came from in time and what contributed to it, you make a supply-side argument, whereas Mr. Bernstein, a notable economist, makes a demand-side. So let's start with the supply-side. What does he mean by supply-side case for where the ghost army comes from?
Oh, he is saying that my argument is mainly about holding back labor, men not supplying their labor into the workforce because maybe they're on disability or maybe they're doing something else, but they're holding back their labor. Whereas his argument is that the more important point is that demand is weakening, that demand, especially for less skilled work, has been weakening over time. So both Jared, who is now at the Council of Economic Advisors in the Biden administration, and Henry, who is more conservative at the Ethics and Public Policy Center think tank in Washington, both of them, for different reasons, are convinced more by the idea that economic and structural change is behind this dramatic transformation I described.
So your presentation is that supply side, these men are not prepared to work or have distanced themselves from work, or they have deliberately avoided skills such as graduating from high school, for example, to provide the opportunity to work because that's not a major focus for them. On the demand side, it would be that the factories or the coal mines went away and we've got to adjust or make a transition. That would be the big government part of this. There's also the matter of the baby boomer, that's me, aging out. How does that contribute?
Well, with the aging out of our baby boomers, that tends to make society grayer in general. It tends to be part of a graying of society. And all other things being equal, if people over the age of 55, let's say, or over the age of 65, have lower work and labor force connections than younger people, that tends to depress the overall employment rates for the adult population.
Okay. Now, I want to go back to your original case because there's some statistics here that seem to speak in opposition to some of these observations. Let's go to the LFPR of the native-born versus foreign-born. Mm-hmm. That isn't about changes in labor force. That's about men coming here to work, to find their work wherever they can, correct?
Correct. And, John, even more to that point, more apropos, look at the work rates and labor force participation rates of American guys who do not have high school degrees. They're the most disadvantaged educationally of any group in the labor force. And yet foreign-born and married guys with no high school degree have work rates and labor force participation rates that are just about the same as native-born college grads.
Also, regional. You would expect regional declines, not specific to towns. And yet, Nick, you provide that West Virginia is next to Maryland. West Virginia has one of the largest, highest, and not in the labor force, and Maryland has one of the lowest. Same for Maine and New Hampshire. Maine has one of the highest, not in the labor force. New Hampshire has one of the lowest. That appears to me to mitigate the case for demand side.
Well, if we have a national economy and a national labor market, it would seem more than passing strange that you'd have extraordinarily high rates of inactivity in one state that is adjacent to another one with extraordinarily low levels. I mean, we have invented U-Hauls, after all.
And that leads me to one detail that you and I need to touch on, which is in your chapter, criminality. I do not believe, I think you make it very clear in your book, that we don't have accurate or available or comprehensive statistics about men who have been incarcerated and are now out of jail, or men who are coming out of jail and how they live the rest of their lives. We don't have those statistics adequately. Is that correct, Nick?
We practically don't have them at all. When I started this book, I thought that I would just go to the statistical abstract and look at the chapter on employment rates for ex-cons. And it turned out there was no chapter like that. As I looked further, even the Bureau of Justice Statistics doesn't keep a head count on how many ex-cons there are in the United States, much less income, much less health, much less working patterns. So we now have an invisible population at this date with the revised new edition of the book, where we probably have 25 million invisible ex-cons in the United States, overwhelmingly men, of course.
And what we have then is no clear understanding of how much they're how many of the ex-cons are in the NLIF, how many of them are what we call the homeless. How many of them are vulnerable to drug overdose? You know, over 100,000 have died recently on drug overdoses. We don't have those stats. Is that correct?
No, we don't have those stats. I mean, I think it's kind of shocking. It's all the more shocking because our system of government was set up as a evidence-based policy system of government. Back in 1790, we had a national population count, which was pretty high tech when you think of it for back in the 18th century. But for some reason, we have forgotten or neglected to track this population.
The book is Men Without Work. Nicholas Eberstadt is the author. He has updated it. It has a new introduction. It also has comments by Jared Bernstein and Henry Olson. And we're going to turn to the post-pandemic chapter, because afterwards there are significant changes. Nicholas Eberstadt of the American Enterprise Institute, a political economist, holds the Henry Wendt Chair at the Institute, author of 20 books. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.